Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Welcome to Money for the Rest of Us, a personal finance show on money, how it works, how to invest it, and how to live without worrying about it. I'm your host, David Stein, and today is episode 102. It's titled, What It Takes to Be a Value Investor. 1999 was an amazing year for the U.S. stock market. U.S. large company stocks, as measured by the S&P 500 index, gained 25.2%, rising for the ninth consecutive year. In seven of those 9 years, the S&P 500 appreciated double digits, leading to an annualized return of 17.8% from 1991 to 1999. The NASDAQ, a U.S. stock index with a large representation of internet-related technology stocks, performed even better. It gained 86% in 1999. One out of six NASDAQ stocks appreciated over 100% that year, and 44% gained over 1,000%. By year-end 1999, the top 100 names in the NASDAQ were selling for an astounding 136 times trailing 12-month earnings. That's a price-to-earnings ratio, PE, of 136. 5 years earlier, in 1994, those same stocks were selling at a valuation of 23 times trailing 12-month earnings, or a PE of 23. Investors justified investing at these lofty valuations because it was the new economy. The world was going to be transformed by the internet, and the old brick-and-mortar companies would be eaten for lunch by hungry startups with .com in their names. During this period, traditional value managers who sought to purchase stocks at a discount to the company's intrinsic value suffered terribly. There are plenty of stocks that met those value managers' criteria, particularly in small-cap stocks and mid-cap stocks. But holding them meant they significantly underperformed the market averages, because during this period, it was the biggest of the biggest names, and the market was being driven by technology stocks, internet-related stocks, and big-cap stocks. Those managers were losing clients who considered them dinosaurs for not adjusting their investment process for the new internet age. In March 2000, I flew to Chicago to meet with one of those beleaguered managers. His name was Robert Sanborn, and he managed the Oakmark Fund. This was the flagship mutual fund for the investment firm Harris Associates. Our institutional investment advisory firm had used Oakmark and Harris Associates as a value manager for our endowment, foundation, and pension clients for years. The main purpose of my meeting with Sanborn was to see how he was holding up amid the market bubble and to confirm he wasn't going to change his investment process and style, despite disgruntled clients pulling millions of dollars from his fund. The meeting was on a Friday, and I left Harris Associates' offices confident the firm would stick to their investment discipline. In the meeting, Sanborn reiterated much of what he had written in early 1999 to the Oakmark Fund shareholders. Here's a quote from that shareholder letter. Unlike many mutual fund managers, we never ponder whether a stock is going up. Rather, we always populate our fund with holdings that sell at the biggest discount to their true intrinsic value and have owner-oriented management. Period. There are those who now say value is dead or the world has changed. I disagree. In our experience, price and value always come together, and that dynamic allows the Oakmark Fund to add value. Sometimes, as now, this process takes longer than some would like. However, as an investor in the fund and as one who totally believes in our investment philosophy, I will never abandon our approach. I know it works. The Monday after my meeting, Harris Associates notified us that they had fired Sanborn as portfolio manager for the Oakmark Fund, and he was leaving the firm. We were absolutely shocked. Apparently, the mutual fund board had lost confidence in Sanborn, and the financial pressure of cash outflows from the fund was just too great. What's ironic is after the move, Harris Associates experienced even more outflows, as our firm pulled hundreds of millions of dollars of our clients' assets from the Oakmark Fund and from separate accounts that Harris Associates managed. One of our investment tenets is you have to have an investment culture, and you stick to your investment discipline. And they caved. They put cash outflows, investment flows ahead of their investment discipline, in our opinion. Now, the fund continued to do fine. The new manager did fine, but it was the issue of they violated one of our investment tenets. That same month, March 2000, our firm published a paper I had written titled, Should Fiduciaries Overweight Growth Stocks in Investment Portfolios? I worked on that paper for months because what we were seeing in our client portfolios, they didn't want to rebalance. Their growth style has done so well, while the value style, including investments in firms like Harris Associates, had suffered terribly. They were underperforming. And so you had an overweight in the growth style investing. So I spent hours in the library of my alma mater, University of Cincinnati, digging through academic journals, trying to understand whether the investment world had indeed changed. I'd only been an investment professional for 5 years, and it was all during a raging bull market with double-digit type returns. I distinctly remember my first year in the investment business. The S&P 500 was up 37%. And I didn't have any historical perspective to figure out, is this normal or not? And so as I was going through the library, researching articles on value investing, on growth investing, and one of the thoughts was, maybe it really is different this time. From my research, I learned the long-term performance of stocks is driven by three building blocks. And I use these same three building blocks to estimate returns for stocks over the next 10 years, as we do on the Money for the Rest of Us Hub. The three building blocks are dividends, earnings growth, and what investors are willing to pay for those earnings. Every stock has an implied embedded growth rate priced into it. And investors are willing to pay a premium for stocks with higher expected earnings growth than for stocks whose earnings are slower and more erratic. That seems only natural. You would pay more for stocks that are growing faster. But here is the key. A stock will only outperform the market, let's say a major index, so let's say it's a large company stock, it will only be able to outperform the S&P 500 if its actual earnings growth exceeds the earnings growth rate already priced into that stock. Outperformance is not due to a company growing their earnings faster than other companies. All that matters is whether the company grows their earnings faster than what investors have assumed the earnings growth rate will be. In my paper, I wrote, certainly the rise of the internet and other new economy technological advances has had a profound impact on capital markets and on our daily lives. Without a doubt, growth stocks deserve a higher valuation than old economy value stocks since their earnings grow at a faster rate. Nevertheless, fiduciaries that overweight growth stocks in their portfolio must understand that their wager is not whether technology-related growth stocks will change the world as we know it. The answer to that question is a definite yes. Fiduciaries who overweight growth stocks are wagering that Wall Street analysts and other market participants are currently underestimating the earnings growth rate of those new economy stocks, whereas historically they have overestimated earnings growth. If investors are willing to make the above bet, then the relevant question is, does the potential benefit of being correct more than offset the penalty of being wrong? The reason why growth investing lags value investing is this tendency that growth investors overestimate the earnings growth prospects of growth stocks. And then the the stocks or the companies miss their earnings growth rate, or they miss the earnings estimate, and then the stocks fall off. And so it's overzealous investors thinking that good times will continue indefinitely. Whereas value investors have very low expectations. They still need the growth of the value companies to outperform the embedded growth rate priced into value stocks. But because expectations are low, the hurdle is easier to overcome. If you'd like to get a copy of that article I wrote in 2000, and it has a lot of references to old academic articles, I spend months on it. It's a pretty well-written piece. And if you remember my Insider's Guide, you will have gotten a link to that article. But if you're not a member of my Insider's Guide, if you're a U.S.-based investor, if you text the word bubble, B-U-B-B-L-E, to the number 44222, you'll get a text back, so you text your email, and you'll immediately get that article sent to you. Or if you prefer, if you're outside of the U.S., just go to moneyfortherestofus.net on the homepage, sign up for my Insider's Guide, and I'll make sure you get a copy of that article. So it turns out that it really wasn't different that time. While the internet continued to have a profound impact on our lives, investors significantly overestimated the earnings growth prospects of those same technology companies that were revolutionizing the economy. That same pattern continues today with the likes of Facebook, Twitter, Uber, and the next technology darling that comes along. In March 2000, the month Robert Sanborn was fired and the month I released my paper, was also the top of the dot-com bubble. From 2000 to 2002, the NASDAQ fell 67%, obliterating the investment portfolios of many who truly thought it was different this time. Fortunately, in the case of our clients, most did rebalance the portfolio, and because they had significant overweights in growth, and they were spared much of the carnage because in the sell-off of 2001, diversification actually worked because it was so concentrated in technology stocks. They sold off tremendously. But generally speaking, if you had a diversified portfolio, including the value investment style, you did okay. Shortly after the dot-com bubble burst, I brought on a new private foundation client. This was a family foundation, and they were true value investors. They understood value investing, and most of their managers were value managers. One of those managers was Seth Klarman. He ran the hedge fund, the Baupost Group. Seth has been managing money in terms of a partnership since 1983, and he's one of the most renowned investors in the world. In 1991, Klarman published a book called Margin of Safety. I think it only had one edition. You can buy it on Amazon used for $1,600. Now, this particular foundation client wanted me to meet with all of their managers once a year. So I'd fly around the country and I would meet with their managers. And so for a number of years, I met with Seth Klarman. And I've learned more about investing, particularly value investing, from Klarman and watching how he ran his fund, the decisions he made, his thought process, than any other investor I know. And I've mentioned Klarman in the past. Well, I wanted to share with you things I've learned from Klarman about what it takes to be a value investor. And these are things I've learned from him personally. And he doesn't know who I am, right? He probably doesn't even remember meeting with me. So don't get the idea that we're close buddies, because we're not. But I've spent a number of hours with him over the years at one-on-one, and I've read part of Margin of Safety, and I've read pretty much all of his annual letters for many years. And I'm not going to quote him directly, because when it comes to hedge fund managers, it's a little, I mean, you can read, for example, I will quote from him at the very end of this episode, because there is a section of the most recent, his 2015 letter, that got published on Business Insider. So once it's out there, I think it's fine to quote from it. But In terms of letters that I might have, I'm a little queasy about quoting directly because typically these are reserved for the advisor or the client. But I can certainly paraphrase and put it in my own words and share the lessons I learned from Seth Klugman. Now, here are the attributes that it takes to be a value investor. And the first is patience. Klarman used to always say, price and value always come together. And so a value manager is trying to arbitrage the difference between price and value. They're purchasing something that is cheaper than its underlying value. But as Robert Sanborn said, it sometimes takes longer than we would like. You have to have patience for that value and price to come together. And one of the challenges is, and Klarman would say this, being early and being wrong looks exactly the same 99% of the time. One of the risks of being a value investor is that price and value never come together, that there is a value trap. And so you can be wrong or you can be early, and they do look exactly the same. So you need to be patient. But you also need to balance that patience with arrogance. Klarman would say investing is an arrogant act because an investor, when they buy a security, they're effectively saying they know more than the seller as well as other buyers. They have some type of investment edge, competitive edge. So it takes arrogance to invest. Let me pause here to share some words from this week's sponsors. We have a brand new sponsor to our show. It's Yahoo Finance. Yahoo's been around for decades. My first email outside of work was a Yahoo email address. But the financial side, I've used on occasion primarily to get data for dividend histories for particular funds or ETFs. But I was pleasantly surprised to get back on Yahoo Finance to see how it's evolved over the years. Now it's really a financial dashboard where you can get an understanding of what's going on with the markets. There are relevant articles from Bloomberg, Reuters, the Associated Press, and the Yahoo Finance team. You can look at the economic events calendar and see which data series are being released that day and what the consensus is. You can see the pulse of the markets at any time by going to Yahoo Finance. In addition, you could see all of your investments and retirement accounts in one place with Yahoo Finance. You get a consolidated view of multiple accounts. Yahoo Finance serves as a financial hub for your retirement accounts, but also comprehensive financial news and analysis. You need to check out Yahoo Finance, particularly if you haven't been there in a while. Check it out at yahoofinance.com. That's yahoofinance.com. If you've been using Mint to manage your finances, you know they shut down several months ago. Well, let me tell you about the budgeting solution, the financial tracking solution I've been using for the past number of months. It's Monarch Money. Monarch Money is the top-rated all-in-one personal finance app. It gives you a comprehensive view of all your accounts, investments, transactions, and more. You can create custom budgets like I've done. You can set goals, collaborate with your partner. And now you can get an extended 30-day free trial when you go to monarchmoney.com/David. What I like about Monarch is the ability to customize what I want to see. I have custom budget categories, and then I can go on to the dashboard and see where I'm above trend on some of my spending. I especially like that Monarch will never sell your data to third parties or show you ads. After trying Monarch myself, I understand why it's the top-rated personal finance app. And right now, get an extended 30-day free trial when you go to monarchmoney.com/David. That's monarchmoney.com/David for your extended 30-day free trial. So value investors need to be patient, but they need to be arrogant. But at the same time, they need to be humble. They have to offset that necessary arrogance with a dose of humility, Klarman says. You always have to ask whether you actually have the apparent advantage over other market participants in any potential investment. Do you have a competitive edge? And if the answer is no, the Baupost Group doesn't invest. And so when I would meet with Klarman and learn about some things like this, you ask why I don't invest in individual stocks very often. The question is, do I have some type of edge? Maybe I'm too humble, but I don't think that most investors have an advantage, because to be a value investor, the other criteria you have to be very opportunistic. You have to look for opportunities where there is unsophisticated, forced selling by investors. They're panicking. They're trying to get out at any cost. So you're buying for someone who doesn't know the value of the securities or the assets that they're selling, or they don't care. They just need to get out. And so oftentimes you're buying when everybody is selling, and you have to have some type of competitive edge. And so this takes a lot of work. Things that, like, the Baupost looks for is they're looking for companies that are messy. And I've seen this with other value managers. They like things that are not straightforward. They like investments that take a lot of legwork to get that informational edge, because many investors are lazy, right? It isn't as simple as screening, do a quantitative screen for which value stocks are cheap. You need to dig in even harder. And things that they're looking at is there important change in the business results or investment expectations? Is the company restructuring or reorganizing? Are they issuing new securities that are being swapped out for new securities being swapped out for old ones? Are there securities that are out there that are complex and subject to selling pressure? Are there asset classes that are capital starved, or areas where people are just trying to get out? And so because there's not enough capital, if you put capital in there, you can get an advantage. But oftentimes you have to wait for opportunity. Being a value investor means waiting for those opportunities, which means oftentimes value investors hold cash, and they're willing to. They're not under this mandate where they feel like they have to be fully invested. And it is very, very difficult for a lot of professional managers to hold cash, because when you hold cash, you might not get paid very much to hold that cash. But sometimes holding that cash gives you the dry powder and the opportunity to buy when those securities, when you can actually find something that is at a significant discount to its underlying value. So value investors are patient, arrogant, humble, opportunistic, and finally, they have a true understanding of risk. Klarman used to say that they are in the business of both risk-taking and risk avoidance. And risks that they seek to avoid are market risks, such as the equity market could tumble, interest rate risk, the impact of rising or falling interest rates on investments, the risk of inadequate diversification, they worry about country risks, such as political, social, economic woes, they worry about credit risks, a company could default. But to achieve a return, you actually have to, you want to avoid risk, but at some point, you have to incur risk. And the issue is risk is not volatility. Risk is how much can you lose investing? What's your potential loss? And what is the probability of losing it? And that's often very, very difficult to do. Klarman would say, it's unquantifiable in looking forward, but also looking backward in time, it's very, very difficult to figure out how much risk you took, because there could have been things that may have happened that didn't happen that you were completely unaware and you just weren't able to evaluate, you weren't aware of it. So it's very, very difficult to assess risk, but you have to balance, but you still have to do it. So you do your best to see what's the worst case scenario, what's the probability of that happening. We do that on the Money for the Rest of Us Hub in terms of when we look at investing in asset classes, what is the maximum potential loss? And for that, we typically have to look at it historically. For the U.S. stock market or the global stock market, it's about a 54% loss. So you have to weigh that in. So we're less worried about volatility, more worried about how much you can lose and what the probability that you'll lose it. So it can be difficult to assess risk, and risk is a function of price. So as stock valuations go up or other asset classes go up, then risk is increasing because the potential, if you buy high and it falls, that you lose money. And Klarman says it's relatively easy to know what to do when the markets are at extremes. So when stocks such as 2009 are dirt cheap, as are other asset classes, it's pretty easy to know what to do. But when they're selling at 30 times earning, it's also easy to know what to do. You don't own them. But oftentimes, investing is somewhere in between. So you're always making incremental trade-offs between risk and return, and it's challenging to do. Klarman says one of the most difficult challenges facing an investor is the decision to end one analysis and actually make an investment. Knowing you have less than perfect information and you're scared that something will go wrong. It's never as easy in practice as it seems when we're writing about it. So when you write about it afterwards, it's much easier. But he says the best investments they've ever made in retrospect seemed almost like free money. It just didn't seem that way at the time that they made them. And one of the, I recently surveyed the members of the Money for the Rest of Us Hub just to see how we can improve the hub. But one of my questions is what's their biggest investment challenges? And one of the biggest worries is fear of making a mistake. That's normal. Even somebody like Seth Klarman, the Bow Post Group, when they finally pull the trigger, when they show that arrogance and they believe they have that competitive edge, they do so, they're afraid. They're afraid they're going to make a mistake. And they try to have that margin of safety, just like the book talks about, that he wrote, so that they're protected when something happens that they didn't anticipate. And what I find, and which is one reason I don't invest in individual stocks, is it seems that the more specific your investment in a particular company, the more things that are out there that could go wrong that you didn't anticipate. Whereas when I buy a basket of securities using primarily index funds, there are, and they're cheap, if I can get them cheap, unfortunately, they're not always available at the dirt cheap as they were in 2009. But when you try to get a basket, then there's less specific things that could go wrong, and you're sort of buying a basket full of embedded surprises. In Klarman's 2015 year-end letter, as quoted by Business Insider, he writes, "Do we ever mention that investing is hard work? Painstaking, relentless, and at times confounding. Separating relevant signal from noise can be especially difficult. Endless patience, great discipline, and steely resolve are required. Nothing you do will guarantee success, though you can tilt the odds significantly in your favor by having the right philosophy, mindset, process, teams, clients, and culture. Getting those six things right is just about everything. Complicating matters further, a successful investor must possess a number of seemingly contradictory qualities. These include the arrogance to act and to act decisively, and the humility to know that you could be wrong, the acuity, flexibility, and willingness to change your mind when you realize you are wrong, and the stubbornness to refuse to do so when you remain justifiably confident in your thesis, the conviction to concentrate your portfolio in your very best ideas, and the common sense to, nevertheless, diversify your holdings. A healthy skepticism, but not blind contrarianism. A deep respect for the lessons of history balanced by the knowledge that things regularly happen that have never before occurred. And finally, the integrity to admit mistakes, the fortitude to risk making more of them, and the intellectual honesty not to confuse luck with skill." I spent years searching the country and the globe, to be honest, for managers that had those attributes. And co-leading a research group, there were 20 of us, trying to find those same managers. They are difficult to find, and then to put them together in a portfolio and to keep our clients to give, so they could have the necessary patience to not fire an Oakmark fund or the other value managers during the internet bubble. Really, really difficult to do, which is why I decided, isn't there a way to make it simpler? There are successful managers, value managers that have the attributes that we've discussed today, and they can outperform the market, but you have to be contrarian. You have to be patient, arrogant, opportunistic, and flexible, and understand risk. I decided I would rather focus on value investing, but focus on asset classes, and be willing to adjust my portfolio based on what's going on, not trying to predict the future, but when something got expensive, to not own so much of it, or when it's cheap, to own more of it, or when the economy is heading toward a recession, to reduce my risk and be willing to wait to see how things play out. That's how I invest, and that's how I learned to invest, some from Seth Klarman, from some other renowned investors, but doing it in a way that I didn't have to spend so much time digging in the weeds for individual securities, because I found I didn't have the patience to do the legwork that's really required to do it well. On the Money for the Rest of Us Hub, one of the things that came out of that survey is investors would like even more specific help. So this month, April 2016, I will be releasing model portfolios with specific ETF and fund holdings for individuals that are on different risk tolerances. So a conservative portfolio, moderate portfolio, aggressive portfolio. And this will make it easier. You'll have the model allocations. You'll have example ETFs, but now you have some actual model portfolios to look at and say, all right, here's the attributes of a model portfolio. Here's the expected return. How does that mesh? And here are the funds, the ETFs to implement that. So that's this month on the Money for the Rest of Us Hub. You can get more information on that at moneyfortherestofushub.com. Show notes for this episode are at moneyfortherestofus.net. That's also where you can sign up for my insider's guide and get a summary article sent to you each week, a synopsis of that week's episode. If you would like the article I wrote in March 2000 about growth investing, you can get that if you're a U.S. investor by texting the word bubble to 44222. Or you can go to moneyfortherestofus.net and sign up there for the insider's guide. Everything I've shared with you in this episode has been for general education only. I have not considered your specific risk profile. I've not provided investment advice. And I don't provide investment advice on the Money for the Rest of Us Hub. That is general education, even though I'm providing models. Ultimately, I'm not giving specific advice. You need to make your own decisions. Have a great week.